Well, hey, welcome to Mercy Church. My name's Spence. I'm one of the pastors here, and it's going to be worshiping with you guys. And there you are. Look at the lights coming on. Good to see you. Hey, before we get into today's passage, to our message for today, I want to kind of give you a heads up on where we're going over the next few weeks. Got some exciting stuff. So starting next week, we're beginning a new series that we're calling My Problem with God. All right, it's going to be about a six-part series. We're going to be trying to provide answers to some of the common questions that are really problems people have with the Christian faith. So things like, why would a good God allow suffering? Or do you really believe there's only one way to God? Doesn't that seem a little arrogant, right? Or you really believe the Bible is God's word? That seems a little antiquated. Things like that. We're going to try and really present reasonable responses to these common questions, and at the same time hold high this message, the Christian faith, to the others will see it as both reasonable and hopeful and powerful. And that's what we're going to be doing. Now, here's a cool thing. I told you a couple weeks ago when I told you about this series that we're going to try and have some fun with it. Right in the middle of this series, Mercy Church is going to be celebrating its second birthday. Yeah, right. All of our, there's a few people that were on our launch team when we launched 2 years ago. They're like, I can't believe we made it. Like 2 years, and it's amazing. But we're going to be celebrating our second birthday. So here's what we're going to do. We decided we are going to turn it up a little bit for our second birthday. So we're going to spend 2 weeks worshiping in one service together. So September 10th and September 17th, we're going to have one worship service. That worship service is going to be at 10:30 a.m., and it is going to be at the Knight Theater in Uptown Charlotte. Yeah, I know, getting a little fancy, Mercy Church. Yeah, we're going to have some fun. I'm really excited about this. This is a great series anyways to invite non-Christian friends to. Maybe people a little bit more skeptical about the faith. But we, long ago, when we planted Mercy, we wanted to be a church for the people of Charlotte. And this just gives us a moment to really exemplify that. That room that we're going to be in holds about 2 to 3 times the number of people that this room can hold, which means we're going to need to all invite our friends and really make it a big weekend or a couple of weekends for us as a church to invite people. We're creating room. Parents, don't worry. We have our Mercy Kids Ministry is going to be up and running. And next weekend, the 27th, we'll be giving you kind of all the inviter stuff that you can use, whether that's images you can post on social media or inviter cards, anything else you can use. We'll give you all that stuff next weekend. But I want to just put it in front of you and say, hey, this is what's coming. We're pretty excited about it. Okay, so that's coming the 10th and the 17th. All right, now this week we're wrapping up our series that we've been calling Signs and Wonders, where we've been walking through the opening chapters of the Gospel of Mark, and that's where we're going to be again this week. If you're newer with us, we've been in this spot in the Gospel of Mark, watching Jesus, different scenes where kind of the raw power of Jesus is put right out in front and on display. And the reason that Mark does that is Mark, in this gospel, is trying to make a big sweeping declaration that Jesus is the king of the world, right? And he's just going to say, Jesus is the king of the world, and therefore, if that is true, you have to shift your whole life to being under his authority, because he's going to make the claim that Jesus is your king and he's my king. Well, Mark knows that that's a pretty bold claim to make, so what he's doing is he's showing you the power that Jesus has, basically as his legitimacy as the king of the world, the king of the whole universe. That's what he's doing. Look, I've been really encouraged by how our church, I love our church anyways, you guys are awesome, but I've been really particularly encouraged by how you've responded to this series, how you have leaned into the power of God. I've been really excited for those of you that have given your life to Christ over the course of this series. It's been cool to hear your stories. Others of you that have kind of returned to your faith, so to speak, that you've been wandering for a little while. Some of you that have finally broken free from sin or had some real healing from some suffering that you've been in. But man, we are not done yet. I think we have saved the best for last. I don't know if you can say like one scripture is better than the other though, but this is really good. Okay, today we're going to see Jesus's power over the greatest enemy the human race has ever known. And we're going to see the clearest moment yet where Mark is sending a message straight through this story, straight through his gospel to you and I, basically saying, man, what are you going to do about Jesus? What are you going to do about Jesus? So we're going to be in Mark chapter 5. So you got your Bible, open that up, turn that thing on, however it is that you get there, and go over to Mark chapter 5, starting in verse 22. That's where we're going to be, starting in verse 22. If you were here last week, we covered the first half of Mark chapter 5. Pretty wild stuff went down, and now we're going to see some even crazier things in some regard. So we're going to start in verse 22. If you're newer to Mercy Church, is how it kind of roll. Usually we just sort of walk through the passage, kind of help us understand what's going on, then we'll come back around and give a few, basically a few things for what are we supposed to take away from what we're seeing here, okay? So we'll start by going through it. Everybody ready? Yeah. Interactive experience, all right? Here we go. Verse 22. One of the synagogue leaders named Jairus, all right, real quick pause. Jairus would have been, as a synagogue leader, basically a big deal in the city. That's actually one of the reasons Mark names him, to show you, this is an important guy, big deal in the city. That's important as we keep going, okay? One of the synagogue leaders named Jairus, he came, and when he saw Jesus, he fell at his feet, and he begged him earnestly. My little daughter is dying. Come and lay your hands on her so that she can get well and live. Verse 24, Jesus went with him. Now look, what you got to make sure you notice here about Jairus' approach to Jesus is that grown men, even now, don't like typically go and grovel at other men's feet. But especially for a guy like Jairus, who's like a big leader, well-known leader in the city, a man of his stature, to fall down at his feet and to beg him for something, both are shameful actions, far beneath him. Why'd he do it? Well, it's kind of obvious in there, right? His little daughter is dying. Luke recalls the same situation, and Luke's going to say that it was his only daughter. The end of this chapter, Mark's going to say the little girl's about 12 years old. This is a little girl. This is a little girl, and she's dying. And when your little girl is dying, you get desperate. All right, and what you do is you sacrifice your pride and anything else in order to save her. See, desperation, what we're going to see time and again this morning is that desperation acts like a sledgehammer that busts through the walls that pride will build in your life. And that's what's happening here. The next thing that happens, we kind of get this unexpected, right in this tense moment, an unexpected pause almost in Jairus' story as we look at another story that Mark weaves in here because the whole thing happens at once. So look at this, verse 24 keeps going. And a large crowd was following and pressing against him. Now a woman suffering from bleeding for 12 years, it was 25, look, trying to figure out how to explain this to you, and there's just no other way to say this, that means, a woman suffering from bleeding for 12 years means that she had an unceasing menstrual flow for 12 years. You gotta take a second and think about how this makes this woman feel. She has this problem because look, something's wrong with her body. She's sick. It's a chronic condition. It means she's in pain. It means she can't have kids. And on top of all that, in her day, this means that she is considered unclean. And by unclean, what this means is she cannot touch another person because she would make that person unclean. So for 12 years, she's been hurting. She's been sick. She's been in pain and literally has no one to lean on. No one to give her a hug and tell her it's going to be okay. 12 years. Verse 26, it even starts to pile on. She had endured much under many doctors. She had spent everything she had, was not helped at all. On the contrary, she actually became worse. She tried everything. She went to all the specialists. They couldn't help her. She spent her life savings and got nothing. In fact, now she's worse off than when she started seeking help. I was talking with Courtney. I was like, all right, seems like a woman's perspective would be particularly helpful in this situation. So tell me how... I know you've never obviously been here, but how would this make you feel? And she said the way she kind of articulated it was that I would feel exhausted, hopeless, and weary deep in my soul. And I thought it was a great articulation of people that go through chronic pain. If you've ever been through chronic pain or you know someone that has, you know this. It makes you feel hopeless, like everything else hasn't worked, right? Your mantra becomes, I don't want to get my hopes up because I'm just going to get disappointed again and again. But watch what happens, verse 27. Having heard about Jesus, she came up behind him in the crowd and touched his clothing. For she said, if I just touch his clothes, I'll be made well. She heard about him. Don't wash over that because you're getting to the touching his clothes part. She heard about him, heard about how he'd been healing people, that he had power. The only reason she went was because she had heard from others about how Jesus had the power to heal people. It's a quick question for you. Have the people around you in your life heard about the power of Jesus to heal them? Have they heard about what God, Christian, listen to me, have the people around you heard about what God has done for you? And if not, What's holding you back? Share what God has done for you. Make Jesus the hero of your story and share with everybody you can about the power of God to rescue people from their sin. That is why she heard. Okay, anyways, having heard it, she acted. Now remember, she's not allowed to touch anybody. This crowd's pressing around. She should not be in this crowd. She, remember, she's going to make them all unclean, which means, look, she's already had she got this reputation for who she is, an unclean person. She starts going up doing this. They're just going to banish her entirely. You got to understand she's risking everything. Why is she risking everything? Because she's desperate. And desperation acts like a sledgehammer to the walls that pride will build in your life. Look, she doesn't care. She can't afford to care what the crowd thinks about her. I know plenty of people they'll keep from getting too close to Jesus because they're worried about what the crowd will think. Not this woman. She's going. She doesn't care what people in her office are going to say about her. She doesn't care that her parents are going to think that maybe she's joined a cult or something because she's actually just gotten serious about following Jesus. She says, no, forget it. Forget all of it. She moves in and she grabs hold of him. Grabs hold of his clothing. She's tired. She's hoping. She's desperate. She said, if I can just touch his clothing. You get that belief? That belief is that this guy just must radiate power. Why else would she must radiate healing power? In verse 29, instantly her flow of blood ceased, and she sensed in her body that she was healed of her affliction. Y'all, she grabbed on to healing power, and she was healed. 12 years of trying all different sorts of things with nothing actually ended up worse off, but she grabs on to Jesus, and she is healed instantly. Instantly. We're going to come back to so much that means for us. Verse 30. At once, Jesus realized in himself that power had gone out from him. So he turned around in the crowd and he said, who touched my clothes? All right, now this verse can mess with me, or at least mess with me. It might mess with you a little bit because at first read, I'm like, does Jesus not control his power? Right? Can you like sneak up on God and snatch healing? Like, is that how that seems a little odd to me? And on top of that, you know, it's like, is God's power kind of like that fresh-baked cookie that Courtney leaves on the lower countertop and then you go in and you take it and then you just blame one of your siblings later, right? Is that what God's healing? And does he not know who touched him? Of course Jesus is in control. And of course he knows who touched him. This question that he's asking, who touched me, it's not for his benefit, it's for hers. Like when that cookie goes missing, right? We walk in the other room, there are four kids looking at us, one of them, her face is covered in chocolate, right? And we ask, who took the cookie? Well, we're not asking because we need to investigate more, right? It seems pretty evident. No, we're giving her a chance to own it. It's my littlest one, always. That's why I'm saying her. But we're giving her a chance. Look, Jesus is giving this woman a chance. He's giving this woman a chance to make her faith public. He's calling her to that. She was hoping that Jesus would give her a quick fix to her problem, and then she could slip back away. But Jesus has so much more for her than that. Listen, when you come to Jesus, you will get way more than you asked for, but it will also cost you more than you ever thought that it would. That's what's happening to her in this moment. Discipleship, y'all, it's not about getting the miracles of Jesus. It's about knowing the person of Jesus, and he's making her go public. He wants her to own what God has done for her. Y'all, by the way, this is why baptism, we make such a big deal about that around here. You were never meant to keep your love for Jesus. You were never meant to keep what God has done for you private. That was never intended that way. You can't touch Jesus, experience the power of God saving you, rescuing you from your sin, and then just run back into the crowd. Your story of what he's done for you, he wants you to declare it because it's really his story. And it gives him glory when you do it, when you own it publicly. And that starts with baptism. And some of you need to step out of the crowd and own it. You need to come to us. We're down here after every service. Talk to us. We baptize regularly around here. You need to take that step. Trust Jesus and own what he has done for you. Verse 31. His disciples said to him, because remember, he just asked, who touched me? Okay. You see the crowd pressing against you, and yet you say, who touched me? These poor guys. I mean, they're like us. They're just unaware of what Jesus is really doing. They're trying, though. I give them some credit. All right, I used to mock these guys. used to be like those disciples, not the sharpest tool in the shed. You know, he used to say this sort of thing. But the more I walk with Jesus, the more I realize he is doing so much more in a moment than I am ever aware of, right? I mean, they're like, dude, really? Who touched you? That's like saying who touched the guy at the bottom of the pile who recovered the fumble. Everybody touched you, man. Verse 32, but he was looking around to see who had done this. The woman, with fear and trembling, knowing what had happened to her, came and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. Look at her. She's trembling. And just like Jairus, she falls down before him. She's at his mercy. The mob rushing to Jairus' house has stopped. I mean, imagine, we had the PGA last week, right? I've found golf to be this fascinating event where it's the only one where the crowd is always on the move. It's kind of crazy, right? So you got this horde of like 30,000 people moving around the golf course. But then when the guy's about to hit a shot, it stops and goes completely silent. So silent you can hear a bird chirp. It's pretty wild, right? That's what's happening here. This mob that's been rushing to Jairus' house just sits and stops. Now, what is he going to do to her who has touched? She, the defiled one, has touched him. Verse 34, daughter, he said to her, your faith has saved you. Go in peace and be healed from your affliction. Y'all, I want you to lean in here, okay? Lean into what's happened. This is huge for understanding why Mark is telling us this story. My old pastor taught me this very important truth in this passage years ago. In this moment, what we're seeing is Jesus reversing the natural order. See, remember, the woman is unclean. And Jesus is not just, you know, a man in the eyes of the crowd. He is a teacher of God's law, which makes him a holy man. For the unclean woman to touch the holy man would defile the holy man. It would make him unclean. Again, it'd make any person unclean, but it's almost like it's doubly offensive because of who it is that she's touching. And again, how bad it is, it's going to make him unclean. Think about it like, to understand this, like when you have a cold, right? If I get around you when you have a cold, you don't catch my wellness. What? I catch your cold, right? You parents don't drop your sick kids off in Mercy Kids in hopes that they will catch everybody else's wellness. Never do you do that. Message from Mercy Kids, brought to you by Pastor Spence. Okay, so you don't do that, right? No, because that's not how sickness works. Nor can you pass your sickness on like a hot potato. Like, I'll give it to you, now I don't have it anymore. No, your cold spreads to me. Doesn't mean it leaves you. That's what they're believing about this whole unclean thing, that the unclean person would defile the clean person if she touched him. The shocking thing here in the story, catch it, is that when the unclean person touches the clean person, the unclean person is made healthy and clean. Alarm bells should be going off to us as readers and spectators. Mark is foreshadowing what Jesus is about to do on the cross. See, all of us are in the woman's position. We carry the stain of our sin with us. When we come to him, we reach out and grab hold of him. He takes our sin onto himself and he gives us his holiness. We become clean. And Jesus carries our sin. The amazing thing is, of course, our sin is our fault. Our stain is our fault. Unlike this woman, it's not her fault. But this is why Isaiah says the Messiah would bear our griefs and carry our sorrows. He would be wounded for our transgressions, bruised for our iniquities. He took our defilement and he sends us away forgiven and clean to have fellowship with God our Father. The woman went home healed. Where did Jesus go? Jesus went to the cross. Y'all, this is the story of every Christian. The power of God and the love of God are at their heights at the cross, and they are poured out to set you free from your sin, to heal and cleanse you and restore you to God. Verse 35, while he was still speaking, people came from the synagogue leader's house, it's Jairus, and said, your daughter is dead. Why even bother the teacher anymore? Can you, y'all, can you imagine Jairus' anxiety through this little pit stop Jesus has made? Right? They were being rushed. They were rushing Jesus to save this little girl who was at death's door, and he stops to help a woman with a chronic ailment. Like, she's been sick today, she'll be sick tomorrow, man. Come on. If Jesus is really a healer, this is not just insensitive, this is malpractice. Right? Treating the chronic illness ahead of the acute illness of the head of the dying girl? No way. What are you doing, Jesus? Jairus over going, hurry up. We don't have time. And then the worst news that any parent could ever possibly get ever. Your daughter is dead. That's what he hears. And they say, why bother? Why bother the teacher anymore? That's important. Why bother the teacher? It's too late. He could have healed her, but now, why even bother? And we don't even get Jairus' response to them. There's no words. And maybe that's because there's no words he can pull together. But right before that, y'all, that moment where his desperation, his hope that something could happen is about to tip over into inconsolable grief and agony, right before that moment, Jesus locks eyes with Jairus. Look at verse 36. When Jesus overheard what was said about the whole, why bother him anymore, he told the synagogue leader, he looked at Jairus and he said, don't be afraid, only believe. Now listen, if you've been in church for a while, there is a danger, because that might sound a little cliche, that you'll miss the power of it. All right, it might sound cliche, but you need this truth today. It's never too late for Jesus, ever. Right now, where you want to lose hope, Jairus, right now, trust me. Your mind's reeling in 1,000 different directions. Stop all of it, and lock in here with me, Jairus. Trust me. And some of you need to see Jesus looking over Jairus' shoulder at you. He's saying, trust my timing. Remember how I calmed the storm? I showed you that my grace is compatible with going through storms, even though you might not think so. Well, now I'm telling you that my grace is compatible with what seems like outlandish delays. Look, Jesus is not saying, he's not looking at him and saying, I will not be hurried, even though I love you. No, he's saying, I will not be hurried because I love you. Y'all, he knows what he's doing. I don't think anybody in here likes that truth when they first hear it. Nobody in the middle of pain or panic wants to hear about God's timing. I don't. I know that. What you are seeing here, though, is that he's connecting his timing to his love for Jairus. Think about my life. Think about how Courtney and I tried for a while to have children, and it seemed like it was never going to happen. I found myself going, what's the problem, God? We're doing everything we're supposed to be doing. What are you waiting on? Hurry up. Right? Anybody with 20/20 hindsight, I found so many Christians will look back and now on the other side of it and go, man, I see what God was doing. He wasn't withholding anything good from his children. He was delaying because he loved us. I think about how I wound up planting Mercy Church, being a pastor here at Mercy Church. For years, I had this unsettling of, man, is this what I'm supposed to do? What kind of thing am I supposed to do? And God had prepared all along this timing so that I could get to serve with you people. You people are God's patience to me. Saying, wait and wait. God does not hold out on us. He's not keeping good things from us. He waits sometimes because he loves us. And he says, if you try to impose your understanding of schedule and timing on me, you will struggle to feel loved by me as you should. Verse 37. He goes in. He didn't let anyone accompany him except Peter, James, and John, James' brother. They came to the leader's house, saw a commotion, people weeping and wailing loudly. And he went in and he said to them, why are you making a commotion and weeping? The child is not dead, but asleep. Verse 40 begins with, they laughed at him. Because he sounds kind of insensitive, doesn't he? They're weeping because their little girl is dead. Their laugh isn't humorous. It's the bitter scorn of a grieving family. But Jesus isn't being insensitive. He sees, this, it's kind of like with the disciples, like, who touched me? That whole thing. He's seeing the situation in a way everyone else cannot. Verse 40 keeps going. But he put them all outside, this whole crowd, and he takes Jairus, the child's father, the mother, and then those who were with him, and he entered the place where the child was. Then he took the child by the hand, and he said to her, Talitha kum, which is translated, little girl, I say to you, get up. Immediately the girl got up and began to walk. She was 12 years old, and they were utterly astounded. Little girl, Mark translates it from the Aramaic to the Greek, this Talitha kum thing. It's probably best translated to us in our English as sweetheart. It's not this triumphant shout of a warrior, right? It's tender. It's caring, like going and waking up this little girl from a nap. He doesn't go in and shout like I wouldn't to one of my daughters, little girl, wake up, you know? Leans down beside the bed tenderly, holds her hand, and just at the touch of his hand, He wakes her up from death. From death. The power is overwhelming. Jesus is facing the greatest enemy that the human race has ever known. And he treats it like waking up a little girl from a nap. And of course, she gets up. She starts walking around and they're astounded. And this is what happens when you really experience the power of God. Our emotions and our language never seem so feeble, so inept, as they do when we encounter the power of God in the person of Jesus. Let me show you guys what we're supposed to take away, I think, from these two stories. Both stories, what they're doing is they're telling us the gospel message from different angles. These stories are not primarily about how you can get access to the miracles of Jesus like these two people did. The purpose of these miracles is to show you that God's love for you is so great that even though you're a sinner, he wants to rescue you. He wants to rescue you from the penalty of your sin, and his power is so great that he can rescue you. The stories point you to the cross. That's why Mark puts them in here. They're reenactments, rehearsals of the gospel. Let's start with the woman with the chronic illness. Here's how we see the gospel through her story. Jesus heals us from the affliction of our sin. Y'all, our affliction, it's not primarily physical, it's spiritual. Our affliction is our sin. We are all like this woman because we are all sinners in need of rescue. We are defiled and outcast. Our sin has stained us, left us cast out from the presence of God. Our sin is our fault. We sin and it separates us from God and we feel it. We feel like imposters around our peers. If only they knew what we had done, if they knew the guilt of the things that we've done wrong that we're carrying around with us. We're guilty, broken sinners. Whether you want to own that or not, it's true. And like this woman, we have turned to everything to try and fix our brokenness. Blaise Pascal, 1670, he wrote this book called The Pensées. And in it, he said one of his central premises there, he said that we have tried to fill, that sin has created this void right in the center of a human soul. And we try to fill it with everything so that we can finally feel complete. Every created thing we try and fill with, he said, this is our hopeless quest that every person is on. Think about it. Think about the things we try to fill that void with so that we can feel complete, we can feel settled, we can feel at peace in our soul. We go after education, we go after technology, we go after romance, we go after different versions of escapes, we go after even morality. But education hasn't fixed our sin problem. We haven't PhD'd our way out of sinning. We've just gotten a lot more clever at it. Right? Technological advancements haven't fixed our sin problems. I had a friend growing up and we used to... This is like 9th, 10th grade, and we're talking about the future, you know, philosophizing and everything as 9th and 10th graders do. You guys understand? And we used to say, man, or he would say to me, man, this world is going to, it's getting better and better and better. One day, it's going to be like a utopia, and there will be no problems, and everything will be chill, and our kids are going to grow up without having any pain whatsoever because the world is going to be so calm, and everybody's going to be living in peace and harmony with one another. Well, hadn't exactly happened, right? I mean, instead, my kids are growing up in a world where Nazis aren't characters from history books. They are representing a real and present day evil. And that's just last week, right? The world is not better because of technological advancements. That hasn't fixed our sin problem. Romance doesn't fix our sin problem. We think a relationship, that's what'll make me secure. You know, you complete me. Nope. Tom Cruise lied to every one of us, and we got to deal with it, okay? You don't complete me, right? Divorce is normative in our culture, and even where there's a hookup culture that's now pervasive, and it is creating just depressed, broken people at an alarming rate. Escapes don't work. I had a friend who went back and forth between the bottle and pills for a long time because it would just numb him to the pain of his life. Yet it eventually got to the point where it even lost its effect while he was binging because he'd think, you know what? While he's doing it, he'd be like, I know that my sober life is waiting on me and just depressed by it. Some of you may not escape there, but you escape to things like Netflix, right? You sit beside your spouse ignoring your problems instead of facing them and turning off that stupid rectangle that you've been looking at for hours and hours. Some of you escape into food and you eat your feelings. You escape in different ways. Our escapes don't fill that void. Morality. Morality doesn't fix our problem. People think if I'm a nice person, you know, I'll do some good things. I'll clean myself up. Maybe if I even get a little religious, that'll fix this problem I have. I feel better about myself because I'm a more charitable, more wholesome person. No. You won't feel any better. You'll become a self-righteous person because you think that your new morality will make you superior to those who don't control themselves and who live like you used to. That's the worst kind of sinner of all. That's what a lot of people think about that when they come to church. They think, I'll get religion. Religion will help me out. It won't. In fact, like this woman experienced with the doctors, if all you get is a bunch of things to do and not do, it'll make you worse. And your moral superiority, your pride will blind you to the fact that you're a wretched sinner who cannot do enough good to outweigh the bad done through your sin. You'll be deaf to verses like Isaiah 64:6. It says, all of us have become like something unclean, and all our righteous acts are like a polluted garment. All of us wither like a leaf, and our iniquities, our sin, it just carries us away like the wind. We are all sinners, and your morality blinds you to that. It can't save you. In fact, with these cures, especially with morality like this woman, what you just saw is that we wind up worse off than we went into them. But maybe by the grace of God, you have now been down enough dead-end roads that you're desperate. That's why our story's here, to show us how to finally be cured, how to finally have that void filled. Like this woman, you're going to have to push through the crowd. You're going to have to grab hold of Jesus. You can't hide and hope that being around him is going to work. Plenty of people touched Jesus in this encounter. This woman was the only one that got his power. Why? Because she reached out in desperate faith and grabbed him. Her faith, y'all, this is a great thing. Her faith wasn't perfect. It wasn't, right? You do not need theologically pristine faith in order to access the power of God for you. You need desperate faith. And that's what she has. The point is, you got to reach out and really grab him, which means confess your sin, confess you have no hope without him. And right there, that's where his power is unleashed into your life. When you have no other options and he's the only one for you, it means he'll forgive you, he'll cleanse you, he'll heal you. Y'all, I'm praying some of you today, some of you this, maybe it's this fall season, you will stop being casual with Jesus. We'll grab hold of him. Step out in boldness. Now, when you look at Jairus' story, we see the same beautiful gospel from a different angle. His story tells us that Jesus rescues us from a death that we cannot stop. Y'all, we see ourselves in Jairus, right? We should, because we got to see Jesus is calling us to have desperate faith, to not fear and just believe. And when we do, Jesus says, now that you're there, now that you've thrown yourself fully onto me, now you got to trust me and watch. Trust that I love you and watch what I can do. We need to hear him say, don't fear, just believe. When fear wants to swallow you whole, instead, fix your eyes on me. We need to hear that. But listen, in his story, we are also Jairus' daughter. Jesus faced our greatest enemy, death, and he defeated it. That's the kind of power we're talking about. The Bible talks about the consequences of our sin in terms of a debt. Like we sinned, we incurred a debt, a payment owed for that sin. And that payment owed is death, eternal separation from God. We talked about this a few weeks ago. You remember 1 Corinthians, we were walking through that as a church. 1 Corinthians 15, verse 55, Paul cries out, O death, where is your victory? O death, where is your sting? Right? The sting, he says it, the sting of death is sin. That's how he finishes that verse. And Jesus, what Paul is saying is Jesus has taken the sting out. So we don't fear death anymore. Our greatest enemy has lost its stinger. So now, facing our greatest enemy, when Christ is holding our hand, it's like waking up from a nap. Y'all, Courtney and I, we got four kids. There's nothing more frightening, especially for the younger ones, when we're in a crowd and they lose our hand. They kind of panic and get scared because they don't know what they feel lost. Or even if we're playing, even if it's in our house, we're playing like hide and go seek in the dark, and the littlest one, if she loses my hand and we're in like a dark room, she gets really scared. Why? Because she has lost the one who has the power to get her out of the darkness. Right? That's nothing compared, of course, to Jesus' own loss. He lost his Father's hand up on the cross. He went into the tomb so that we could be raised out of it. Let him take you by the hand. Let him do what he wants to do. He loves you completely, and he knows what he's doing. And if you will give everything to him, he'll take you by the hand, and even death itself would just be a nap. Now, here's the one thing both of these stories are telling you. Jesus responds to desperate faith. There's one thing that I could really press in on us today, guys. Are you desperate for him? Because here's what I see, and I actually experienced this myself. Too many people get desperate for Jesus only when they really have to. You ever feel that? Ever see that in your own life? If that's ever you, Mark is telling you to wake up. If you are not urgently and completely dependent on Jesus today, Sunday, August 20th, if you're not completely dependent on him, you're living in a false reality. Your pride of self-reliance, the ability to get by on your own, has blinded you. It's blinded you to knowing that you desperately need Jesus. Ephesians 6, Paul says, today, put on the full armor of God and every day. Armor. Why armor? Because every day there is a battle waging for your soul. Y'all, that's not preacher overspeak right now. Okay, a biblically faithful description of today, Sunday, August 20th, is that there is an evil one called Satan trying to destroy you, and he's using pride, romance, distractions, even your morality to that end. You are at war with a power much stronger than you. And when you understand that, that's when you'll get urgent and you'll get desperate for God to carry you through it, because the one good news is that evil power trembles at just the sight of Jesus. And that's what we've been seeing all through the opening of Mark. All four stories that we've looked at are really five stories. There's two in this one. In Mark's gospel, said the same thing. There's one thing in common, and that's that we've seen the fear of the power of Jesus. When Jesus heals the lame man, the people fear his power. When Jesus calms the storm, the disciples are terrified. When the demons that are possessing this man that we saw last week, when just at the sight of Jesus, they're terrified. And when Jesus casts those demons out, all the townspeople are so terrified, they run Jesus out of town. We see the woman today trembling, having experienced Jesus' power. We see Jairus, this leader, fall down at the feet of Jesus and marvel. When you see, this is when you really see Jesus for who he is, his power will terrify you. That's how you know you've seen him. But at the same time, his love for you will give you peace in your soul like nothing ever has. And then, if you give him everything, he will reach down and take your hand, and he will walk with you through your darkest days, even through death itself. But are you desperate for him? Here's how we're going to, I'm going to actually give you guys a little bit of a time to respond to that on your own. We're going to take communion together as a way to kind of wrap up this series and really as a response to the gospel message. Our band's going to come and get in place, and you're going to see some people coming to pass out communion. Don't let that bother you. I want you to really do some business with God. This is a time for each of us to personally reflect on, are we desperate for God? If you're not a Christian, listen, just let that plate, you're going to see a couple of plates, just let those pass by you, hand it to the next person. Nobody's going to think anything about that. This actual meal is only for Christians to take. We want you to consider the message that this meal represents. So here's what I want you to do. I want you to take the elements. Again, if you're a Christian, take them as they come by. If not, either way, we're going to be praying about the same thing. I want you to go into a moment of just prayer and reflection. I'm going to come back and lead us to take these elements. Here's what I want you to pray about. This is going to be one of those where everybody's going to kind of bow their heads and really reflect personally. And the question is, are you desperate for God? Are you desperate for Jesus today? And if not, why not? What's the distraction that's keeping you from him? What's the thing that you might be leaning on to fill that void instead of him? And what you need to do is confess that to him. Give that to him. But at the same time, this is a time to celebrate, and you need to spend time praising him for the power that you've seen in your life. The power of God working for you in your life. You need to praise him for that. If you're not a Christian, we'd ask you to consider this claim that you heard several times throughout both of these messages, that God says, yes, you were created to know him, to love him, to walk with him, but your sin has stained you. It has created a debt that you've incurred that can only be paid by blood, but by the grace of God. Because he loves you and because he's powerful enough to do so, he sent his son to pay that price instead of you. Will you believe that today? Will you receive his forgiveness and be cleansed, be healed, be made whole? You take a minute, and you pray, you work through that at your own pace. I'll come back up in just a second and lead us through taking the elements together.